Hey friend, welcome to Girls Night, where we work through life's biggest decisions and transitions together. I'm your host, Stephanie Mae Wilson, and I'm so glad you're here. Let's get started. So as you may know, I have a new book coming out soon called Create a Life You Love. And in it, I tackle what I call the everything era. It's that wildly confusing decade-ish where we have to make some of the most significant decisions of our lives, typically all at the same time. I've spent the last 10 years wrestling with these big life decisions and the pressure that comes with them, and I've talked to countless women who are doing the same. But I didn't know it was a thing, like actually a thing, until about 2 years ago when I heard a statistic I will never, ever forget. In a rare study of lifespan development, researchers at Boston University and the University of Michigan found that 80% of our life's most defining moments happen before we turn 35. In fact, the average woman makes the majority of her biggest life decisions in the decade between her 25th and 35th-ish birthdays. So I wasn't exaggerating. It wasn't my imagination. This season of life is actually as big and hard and consequential as it feels. So that's when I started to dig. I needed more information. I wanted to know more about what's happening in us during these years and what's happening around us. I also started to wonder what these years have looked like for the generations of women who have gone before us, because I realized I didn't actually know. I have learned so much as I've heard stories of women from past generations. And the more I've learned about women's history, the more I understand why our lives look the way that they do today. And that's why I'm so excited to introduce you to today's guest. Our guest for today's episode is my new friend, Sarah Gristwood. Sarah is a former film journalist, and now she writes books about women's history. Her most recent book is called Secret Voices, A Year of Women's Diaries. In it, she analyzes a collection of excerpts from women's diaries, looking back over four centuries to discover how women's experience of men and children and sex and shopping and work and the natural world has changed over the years, and also how it hasn't. Friends, I loved this conversation and I cannot wait for you to hear it. Before we dive in, I wanted to read a little something to you. It's a snippet of my book, Create a Life You Love, because in it, I explain why learning about women's history has meant so much to me. So here's a snippet from my book. Recognizing the pressures women have been under throughout history helps me feel like I'm not alone. I'm part of a large sisterhood and I'm honored to be. This truth is especially helpful to me during times when I start to wonder if the pressure I'm feeling is imagined, if the expectations I'm sensing are really as heavy and forceful as they feel. As I look back at the centuries of pressure and expectations and opinions about women's lives and how they should spend them, I see that, yes, this actually is as big as it feels. And that's so validating. It helps me be kinder to myself as I navigate all of this. I hope it helps you too. Not only is it helpful for me to know that the pressure isn't new, that women have always had people breathing down their necks, telling them what they should do and how they should live, but also the more I find out about the expectations placed on women throughout history, the more I understand why some of the decisions I'm trying to make in my own life today feel so heavy. Friends, Sarah is the best. I can't wait for you to meet her. So, you ready? Let's dive in. Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with samples. Friends, springtime is finally here, but that also means allergy season is in full swing. I have always struggled with allergies, and I don't know about you, but I am especially allergic to cats. More on that in a second. Well, luckily for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. Designed for serious allergy sufferers, Claritin D has two powerful ingredients in just one pill that relieve your allergy symptoms and decongest your nose so you can breathe better. This double action combination of prescription strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. The time that I use Claritin the absolute most is when I'm at my parents' house, my childhood home. They have this absolutely beautiful cat that they love, and I like, except for the fact that he sheds so much. So that means that I'm basically sneezing from the second I arrive home to the second I leave, unless I take Claritin. My dad has even started having it ready for me right when I walk in the door. Are you ready to live life as though you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. Use as directed. Claritin, thank you so much for sponsoring our girls' night. We love having you. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. As many of you know, I recently wrote a book, and while it was the most rewarding project of my career so far, it also came with a lot of hard work and long nights. And sometimes when things started to feel a little bit overwhelming, I needed to get a few things off my chest so I could clear my mind and keep the writing process flowing. And the thing that helped me so much to sort through those feelings was therapy. Now tell me if any of this sounds familiar. Maybe you're going through something really hard right now, a big loss or a gigantic life transition. Maybe you frequently feel anxious, depressed, overwhelmed, or just generally discouraged. Maybe you really, really, really want your life circumstances to change, but you don't know how to actually change them. Or maybe you're feeling stuck as you try to work through your past, navigate your present, or figure out your future. Friend, if you can relate to any of this, you're not alone. I've been there, and therapy has been the thing that has helped me more than anything else with all of this. In the last 10 years or so, I've learned that strength isn't proving I can do it on my own. It's knowing that I don't have to. I'm at my strongest when I have a full support system around me, and an essential part of my support system is therapy. Therapy can be absolutely life-changing. That is, if you can afford it and find a therapist you like and trust. But of course, this is easier said than done, and that's why I'm so excited to be partnering with this week's podcast sponsor. Our sponsor for today's episode is BetterHelp. BetterHelp is the easiest and most affordable way I've ever found to find a great therapist. It's entirely online and super easy to sign up. You can get started right away, and if you don't love the counselor you're paired with, switching is easy and it's free. If you're going through something hard in your relationships, or if you're in a funk you just can't shake, if you've been feeling anxious or depressed lately, or if you're feeling stressed and you need help balancing your everyday life and schedule, BetterHelp is an incredible resource for you. And I'm so thankful that they've given me a promo code that I can share with you to make it even easier to get started. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/friendship today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/friendship. All right, friends, I'm so excited for who you get to meet today. I'm sitting here with my new friend, Sarah Gristwood. Sarah, welcome to Girls Night.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Can you tell us who you are, what you do, and a fun fact about yourself?
Well, I was a film journalist for a million years. Then I began writing books about women's history. And most recently, I've edited Secret Voices, an anthology of women's diaries, a year of women's diaries. The fun fact I planned to share was that I once shared a page of a poetry anthology with William Carlos Williams. But I feel the fun fact may need to be that sitting here beside me, there is, well, theoretically he's a dog. He's more like a great white shark covered in fur. So if something suddenly appears, that's Rex, okay?
Rex, okay. I love it. I love it. Well, Sarah, when you, I have a book of my own coming out on April 30th, which is really exciting. And in it, I'm helping women navigate some of the big decisions that we're faced with kind of during the 25 to 35 year old age range.
Right.
And one of the things that I became just totally fascinated with was what this has looked like for past generations. Like what decisions and options my mom was faced with and my grandmother and women before them. Because I noticed as we're making decisions about motherhood and marriage and career and all these different things, we are being pushed and pulled by historical precedent. So I talk about it a little bit in my book, not as much as I could have devoted the whole thing to it. Yeah. But so when your name came across my email, I just was overjoyed. And I sent a yes, please, can we have her on the show back immediately? Because I want to hear from you. Like I've been brought so much peace and encouragement. Mm-hmm. And also like, I'm also a little angry as I've gotten to hear some of the things that women have gone through, you know, through time. Yeah. So anyway, tell us about A Year of Women's Diaries. Tell us about the book and like where the idea for the book came from.
Yeah. And first, just let me say, I think the women of the past would have been totally with you on the decisions and the peace and the anger. So women's diaries have been a huge interest of mine for many years. So when the idea of me writing a book about it came up, I jumped at it, of bringing together all these voices, because I first started studying them when I was in my 20s, but an awful lot has changed and has come out. It was a while ago, let's admit. So much more material is available now, and people have gone looking for such a much, much greater range of diaries, not just from the wives of famous men or famous novelists, people like Virginia Woolf or Sylvia Plath, but from pioneer women, from abolitionists, from people of all races, all ethnicities, all backgrounds. And what I did find there, it often astonished me, but there was also what I think you were suggesting, that sense of familiarity, that guess what? Many of the dilemmas we think of as just being today were absolutely explored by the women from even several hundred years ago.
It's so cool. Where did people get these diaries?
Well, it's a real mixture. Some of them, of course, were published, even with the writers, the original writers' own knowledge. Others were preserved just by chance. I mean, we all know about Anne Frank writing in the secret ghetto in World War II, but in the secret annex and, in a victim of the Holocaust. Her diary was preserved. We know her sister Margot wrote a diary. No trace of that survives. But some of them have had a pretty interesting history. You mentioned women of perhaps 25 to 30. Well, a couple of these diarists, women who went on to become very famous, wrote a youthful diary in code, codes which were only cracked years after their death. And two of them particularly, Beatrix Potter wrote a diary in code, the author who wrote Peter Rabbit and all those little tales. But the point is, she didn't find herself. She didn't find her path in life. She couldn't break free of her family until she was in her 30s. When she did, her coded diary ended. But before that, she was writing out her, despair, really. And Florence Nightingale, so famous as, the Lady of the Lamp, Crimea, the pioneer of nursing. She again wrote a diary, but again, she was 30 before she managed to cease being a Victorian young lady at home and actually find the path that made her so famous. And her early diary again writes, "My present life is suicide." But guess what? She then moved and bloomed.
Okay, I have goosebumps and I might cry. I just need to put that out there. Tell me, okay, why? How? How were they writing in code?
Okay, Florence Nightingale didn't actually use code. Beatrix Potter did this incredibly complicated one that a man sat down after her death, you know, with her diaries, and tried to crack it. He was just on the verge of giving up when finally he got it. He got the key. The other diary in code I was thinking of was a woman called Anne Lister. Now, here we've seen her life dramatized on TV as Gentleman Jack. But 200 years ago, she was lesbian. She was writing about her affairs very openly, very frankly. So she had, by the standards of her day, a good reason to keep her diary in code. But the point for me was almost that someone like Beatrix Potter, she wasn't writing anything like that. You know, she was writing about, taking her pet rabbit for a walk on a lead and how she'd had all her hair cut off after an illness. But she was also writing out her feelings of frustration, of anger, of the way the male establishment wouldn't take her seriously. And I guess in her day, that was as transgressive as Anne Lister's sexuality.
I have so many questions. Okay.
use these diaries often to voice feelings that they couldn't voice openly in their society.
So you said that with Florence Nightingale and Beatrix Potter, they had sort of a shift around their 30s. What does life look like before then that Florence Nightingale said, my current life is suicide?
They were both Victorian young ladies from good family. So what they were supposed to do was basically nothing until they married. And if they didn't marry, they're nothing. And that was the problem. Florence Nightingale knew what she wanted. She wrote in her diary about how she could happily do without husband, children, but she absolutely felt she had to pursue this need to serve humanity and in a medical way. But of course, at the time she was writing, the Victorian age, well-brought up young ladies didn't go off and tend the bodies of strange men. It was a disreputable profession. It wasn't really a profession for women at all. That's why she had the fight on her hands.
How did she break free from it?
Well, I think she just, with a lot of determination is the real answer. And, you know, I think she recruited some support from a few, you know, influential family friends and so on. And then, of course, quite soon, she became this immensely famous figure, the lady with the lamp.
That's so cool. Okay, so I want to know, after looking through, you know, after combing through 4 centuries of women's diaries, what were some of the common, themes, I guess, that you were seeing in women's lives? Like, what has life looked like for us for the last 4 centuries?
I guess one of them was that sense of frustration, anger, if you like, because even though, you know, a lot of them sort of didn't openly say, "I'm furious," they wrote with wry humor. Or they disguised it. Beatrix Potter, when she went to show, before the Little Tales, she did these drawings of fungi, which were immensely accurate. They're massively respected by the scientific establishment today. They're still used as teaching studies. But at the time, when she was given an introduction to the director of the Great Botanical Garden at Kew, he just brushed her off. And Beatrix wrote, it's very frustrating, very annoying for a shy person to be treated as if they were conceited, especially when the shy person happens to be right. And you do get a fair bit of that.
So they weren't taken seriously.
Yeah. That yes.
And they also...
Yes. And a lot of them were juggling with the sort of question that I think you touched on earlier about whether they could make a life for themselves without marriage, whether they could marry and still keep their own identity. A lot of them had real concerns about that. And some of those questions were couched in such modern terms to me. There's one, 200 years ago, Elizabeth Fry, well known here. She was a Quaker and she was known as a great prison reformer of women's prisons particularly. And she wrote about how she was worried whether her husband and children, 11 children, I think, were distracting her too much from what she saw as her vocation, how her husband and children got annoyed, got jealous when she gave too much time to that vocation. It really is how to juggle a career and family. And guess what? That one hasn't gone away today.
No, it sure hasn't. What else were women, what were women expected to be like? Through what, like, what are some, how have the expectations shifted in the last?
Yeah, well, I think it's an interesting question. I think that's where the diaries came in a way. Because what women were, on the whole, expected to be was kind of sweet, cute, accepting, not too vocal, and of course subordinating themselves to husband and children. So you've got someone like Sophia Tolstoy, the wife of, you know, the great Tolstoy, War and Peace, writing very bitterly about how if you were married to a genius, you were supposed to, and she, you know, that's very bitterly underlined, genius. You were supposed to feed and clothe and tend and make a house and make a comfortable atmosphere and bring up all the children the genius fathered but couldn't be bothered taking care of himself. And if ever you expected so much as a word of thanks from the genius, you'd be lucky. And so really, I think it was that sense that a woman, this is what's changed, that a woman's destiny was husband and children. Now, many of these women, of course, wanted husband. They've, you know, they found men they loved, they wanted and adored their children. But all the same, there was that sense of, yes, but where do I come in? Again, something we know today.
Yeah. Yeah. I heard a statistic recently that talked about the amount of history that was, like, amount of women's history that's been documented versus men's history.
Right.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. I can't tell you in general, but certainly in the anthologies of diaries that were already out there, women, entries from women were nothing like 50%. It was more like, you know, 20% or 30% of the entries, even though the diary has been thought of as particularly a woman's form, because it is private, because it is something that, you know, women can do at home and don't expect to have to go out in the nasty big wide world and publish it.
What, tell me about, what did you learn about women's roles kind of going from Victorian times through the Industrial Revolution. Like, how did the Industrial Revolution change life for women?
Well, of course, one thing we have to say is that, unfortunately, the diary form and the diaries that have been preserved does tend to fade to get to, there's an undue proportion of upper middle class women, basically, who weren't necessarily working in the factories and so on. That's partly where the work I mentioned earlier came in, that there has been a very conscious effort to get diaries from people like, oh, the Victorian maid servant, Hannah Cullick, whose, you know, day is just extraordinary, cleaning the chimneys, cleaning the boots, cleaning. And I think the changes in women's diaries, well, one big one came about really before Victorian, before Industrial Revolution. It was in the, there was a great big surge of women's diaries, diaries in general, in the 18th century. So 200 years ago or more. And I think that was partly to do with the kind of cult of sensibility that suddenly people's feeling, there was more of a premium on people's feelings. And people felt, women felt allowed, even encouraged, to write down their feelings because it proved what a kind of, you know, sensitive soul they were, much in the way that we might today. Whereas before that, perhaps, diaries had tended to be much more factual or a record of spiritual experience. Though, my having said that, quite often, even in the earliest, anger comes through. I mean, I think the earliest, or almost the earliest diary in this book is from Lady Anne Clifford, who was writing more than 400 years ago. You know, she wrote, she was there at the funeral of Elizabeth I, but she got on very badly with her husband, who was trying, with the new king's assistance, to get her to give up her family lands, her maternal inheritance. And she was writing about, whatever he says to me, I will never give up Westmoreland, her own property in Westmoreland. And how she wrote, my lord, her husband, was meant to come and spend the night with her, sleep with her that night, but he didn't because they'd had another row about this property.
It seems like forever women have been trying to figure out their place and how their place, if their place is able to be, if there's still a place for them.
Yes.
If they are married and have kids, like where their place is in relation to a husband and kids. Yes. And then also like not necessarily feeling free to use their voices or to talk about how they really feel and sort of that tension.
Yeah, indeed. And a lot of them do write very directly about it. I mean, I'm thinking of one in the early 20th century, Ivy Jakey, who had a baby and then writing about how relieved she was to find that the impulse to create, to write, hasn't left her. But others, in other women, Naomi Mitchison was her name, saying that she and her friends had been talking about how they were all, I quote, done for by this business of babies. How, much though they loved their children and their husbands, it was virtually impossible ever to get an hour together to themselves, except in the evening, and then they were too tired to do anything creative. Again, pretty familiar now, I think.
That is so wild. That is so wild. Tell me, so one thing that I'm just really struck by is, you know, I know that you've gone through countless diaries. And I mean, I know when we write a book, we're really familiar with the material, but the fact that you know all of their names and the year, like the years and the details, it's just really cool that's really cool. And so I wanted to ask you, you know, why is it important that we publicize these personal experiences? Like why do we need to hear these things?
Because I think we need to know more than we already do what our foremothers were thinking and feeling, and how better to do that than in listening to their own often private, often secret voices. Because I came away feeling that the experience of women in the past was more adventurous, but also more nuanced, much less black and white than we tend to get from conventional history. And I think the real reason that matters so much to us is because it gives us strength. I think that a lot of us who grew up in, like, you know, the late 20th century, say, we often felt that we were frontline troops, you know, fighting the battles to be treated on equal terms in the workplace, that kind of thing. The battle to, you know, not have your partner grumbling about your work when you were at home. And to realize that there is this complete army of other women standing behind us who fought the same battles and moved things on does give an enormous feeling of support and security. Or it does to me anyway.
Me too. Me too. I wanted to know, out of all of the stories that you've heard, what's a story that surprised you? That you were like, I didn't realize that women in the past were thinking this, or I didn't realize this was an option, or just any surprising stories that you came across.
Well, that Elizabeth Fry, the Quaker, and her work and her family was a strong contender. Actually, there's another one from her about how, after a very hard labor, she wasn't managing to bond with her new baby. And you think, well, the term postnatal depression wasn't known in 1812 or whatever it was, but clearly the feeling was. But also, a girl, a woman who died young. She died at 25 of TB, Mary Bashkirtseff, and a exiled, an aristo, an artist. And she was writing incredibly directly and frankly about her ambition as an artist, how she wanted to be known, she wanted to be out there, how she wasn't interested in people who weren't ambitious in any way, and how she didn't see why she should hide hers. Obviously, her early death. I mean, that's something we're a bit hesitant to say, even today, a lot of us.
Yeah.
Her early death obviously meant her ambitions as an artist, a painter, weren't fulfilled. But I like to think she'd have been glad to know that after her death, her published diaries became a Victorian bestseller. So, in a way, she got the fame she wanted.
That's really cool. What were some of the lessons that you've learned from women as you've looked over the last 400 years?
I guess one of the first would be that bad times do pass. I mean, a lot of these women went through some extraordinarily bad times, partly because of the age in which they were living. I mean, it's not in this book because it's written in a different format, but when I read Fanny Burney's many-page description of undergoing a mastectomy without anaesthetic, my chief concern was whether I could get out of the library without throwing up on the floor. So in some cases, these women's hard times came from the age in which they lived, but not always. a lot of it was depression, was self-doubt, was difficulties with a spouse in just the way we know today. But the bad times did pass, even for those few diarists who are known for the fact they didn't, for their suicides, like Virginia Woolf, Sylvia Plath. There's an awful lot of strength and energy and fighting along the way. I think other lessons, I guess, I hadn't thought this before, but I guess it's that if women throughout all these centuries have really cared so much to preserve, to write about their own identity, well, I guess what? Our own identity must be something worth preserving, you know? I think in a way, their value for themselves can give us a greater sense of our own value. Does that sound silly? Does that sound make sense?
Okay. It's something that we think about now, and to know
yes.
Women have been thinking about this forever. It's like, well, this isn't silly.
Yeah. Okay, good.